Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A lingering last look at some of the fruits of the legislature's labors during the session that ended a week ago today.
It was a very emotional moment on the floor when we had to concede it wasn't going to happen. And to get that done, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Also this week, we'll hear the latest on a couple of bills that appeared to stall but managed to somehow stay alive at the end of the legislative session.
As a teacher myself, I know many of my colleagues are not aware of the signs to look for when it comes to suicide prevention, but they're willing to learn.
We'll also get an environmental update from both the state and federal angles and find out who wasn't voting in Florida during this week's presidential primary election. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. There are about 200 bills awaiting Governor Rick Scott's approval or veto. Lawmakers passed a number of measures close to their hearts, but Nick Evans reports they missed out on some legislative opportunities as well.
Thursday, Governor Rick Scott signed the budget, but after missing out on his two legislative priorities, it came as a bit of a surprise just how gentle he was with the veto pen. Ahead of session, Scott wanted $1 billion in tax cuts and $250 million in business incentives. And ahead of session, lawmakers had their own hopes, too.
I've got one that I'll pitch, and that is a change in our cabinet structure that I've proposed. It's creating a Secretary of State position. Bringing
what the bill does is it takes monies that had been moved to general revenue back several years ago, puts them back into the transportation trust.
One of the issues that I'm focused in on is the regulatory structure for medical marijuana. I think the regulatory structure today...
Well, I'm hoping that we might be able to go back and address this crisis in health care again. I really think that it's not a problem that's going to go away until there's a solution.
That was Senator Aaron Bean, Representative Lake Ray, Senator Jeff Brandis, and Representative Joe Geller. So, how'd they fare? Elected Secretary of State? No. Transportation Trust Fund? Didn't even get a vote. Marijuana? Reforms passed, but they weren't Brandis's. And Medicaid expansion? Well, Mitch McConnell would grab drinks with the new Supreme Court nominee before lawmakers would bring that up again. But a lot of policy work did get done. In the first week, House Speaker Steve Crisafulli passed major water legislation, and Senate President Andy Gardner gained approval for a pair of bills aimed at Floridians with unique abilities. This is Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee.
What moved me most was the fact that my Senate president, who had a child with a unique ability, dedicated his 2 years to funding some things that have been left unfunded for a good long while. And it's sort of a tribute to why people are supposed to come here and put the interests of the populace ahead of the special interest groups and the lobbying corps.
And he was pushing those priorities until the very last moments. Just before the close of session, House lawmakers agreed to mandate insurance cover therapies for people with Down syndrome. Gardner was unable to pass that requirement in 2008. Here he is.
Yeah, it 8 years ago, we weren't able to get that done. And it was a very emotional moment on the floor when we had to concede it wasn't going to happen. And to get that done, yeah, it was pretty cool.
For Miami Democratic Senator Oscar Brannon, there's no question what he's most proud of accomplishing this year.
Needle exchange pilot program for Miami-Dade.
He's been pushing for that project now for years.
It has been. That's my number one bill. I think with the news about us being number one in new HIV cases, I think programs that help us to stem the tide are the type of things we need to do. And so this is one of them.
But for Naples Republican Senator Garrett Richter, the thing that stands out the most is a regret.
I'm really disappointed that we didn't confirm Dr. John Armstrong, as the Surgeon General.
Armstrong faced opposition in the committee process, and Gardner opted against forcing a vote on the Senate floor. Governor Scott has tapped Dr. Celeste Phillip as interim Surgeon General. For many lawmakers, the end of session spells the end of their political career. For the rest, it's the starter's pistol for campaign season. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Despite stalling in the legislature, a number of bills still managed to stay alive and were sent to Governor Rick Scott for his consideration. As Sasha Cordner reports, they include a measure involving the recital of the Pledge of Allegiance in schools, as well as another dealing with youth suicide prevention training.
Hannah Johns is a teacher from Lakeland. About 7 years ago, her father committed suicide.
On January 12, 2009, at 8 o'clock, my uncle had called me, and his exact words were, there was an accident and your father didn't make it. Now, I knew my dad had been struggling with depression and alcoholism, PTSD, and so in the pit of my stomach, I knew it wasn't an accident, I knew it was a suicide. At first, no one in my family wanted to admit that it was a suicide, and no one definitely did not want to talk about it.
She says stigma is one of the worst parts of losing someone to suicide.
The stigma is so strong. It was so strong that our pastor refused to let us name the church in his obituary.
John says it was around that time she started getting depressed.
My father was a retired master chief from the Navy. He served 25 dedicated years, and he was so put together. No one would have ever thought that he would have taken his life. I never thought I would experience a suicide in my family, but unfortunately, mental illness does not discriminate. I felt like I had this picture-perfect family, and it was just shattered. I went through the darkest time of my life. I battled depression myself afterwards, and I wanted to end my own life.
She says it was only after she found a support group where there was no stigma that she started to heal. John says she's also healing by joining groups that allow her to be a suicide prevention advocate. And about 2 months ago, she joined others in asking lawmakers to approve a bill aimed at establishing prevention efforts in the classroom.
One of the top issues we're asking our legislators is to support training for educators in how to respond when a student is in distress and may be at risk for suicide. As a teacher myself, I know many of my colleagues are not aware of the signs to look for when it comes to suicide prevention, but they're willing to learn.
The original measure stalled in the House and Senate. It was later included in a controversial school choice bill. And Fort Myers Republican Senator Elizabeth Beniquisto says she's grateful to incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran for getting that done.
Thanks to him, it became a reality, and we hope the governor signs it. It's really amazing that we can work together to put forward that initiative. And we know that just about a year ago, 34 children in the ages 10 to 14 took their own lives. And so this is very meaningful. If we can have folks armed in the classroom to help those kids, it makes us very proud.
Another measure included in that so-called school choice bill deals with the recital of the Pledge of Allegiance. It too had stalled in the legislative process with only hearings in the House. It was a priority for House bill sponsor Doug Broxson, as well as Pensacola Beach Republican Representative Mike Hill, who also sponsored the measure. He says he's glad the measure managed to stay alive.
Well, I'm pleased that it did. It's an important thing that we do say the pledge. We know there's a First Amendment right that if you elect to not say it, no, that's fine. And our current statute says that it must be displayed in a conspicuous place. What this bill did was just make it more clear that the student handbook is a conspicuous enough place so that it doesn't have to be plastered on every single classroom wall.
Hill says it's especially important to so many members of their districts.
There's a large military presence in the panhandle, and what we found was that it was one person who didn't want her child to say the Pledge of Allegiance, who, by the way, that child says it every day now on his own voluntarily. And the school superintendent had received a ruling or an opinion from his legal counsel who told him he needed to post it in every classroom. Well, we thought that was just an overreach.
Hill and Broxson had agreed to file the measure after public outcry during a town hall meeting last year about the displayed classroom signs, telling students they're not required to recite the pledge. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
A state appeals court ruled today that Florida's new death penalty sentencing process should apply to prosecutions that were already underway when the new law went into effect this month. The Fifth District Court of Appeal also decided that a U.S. Supreme Court decision in a case known as Hearst v. Florida did not strike down the state's entire death penalty as unconstitutional, but instead overturned the procedure for imposing death sentences. But because the issues involve questions of great public importance, a three-judge panel asked the Florida Supreme Court to decide whether the Hearst decision declared that the state's death penalty is unconstitutional and if the new law applies to cases already in the pipeline before the new sentencing process went into effect back on March 7th. In a January 12th ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court found that Florida's system of giving judges and not juries the power to impose death sentences was an unconstitutional violation of defendants' Sixth Amendment right to trial by jury. And that ruling left Florida temporarily without a death penalty sentencing structure, prompting the legislature to hurriedly pass a bill intended to fix the process. Under Florida's new law, juries will have to unanimously determine the existence of at least one aggravating factor before defendants can be eligible for death sentences. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers tackle a sweeping water policy revamp during the session, and the result is drawing mixed reviews.
And I think the major question is, are all these risks worth what we would be getting in return?
Florida's closed primary system causes a bit of Election Day confusion.
Some people get confused. They may have been NPAs, non-party affiliations, and they may have expected that they could vote. But the fact is that Florida law does not permit them to vote.
But there's no confusion among Florida's population of former felons, very few of whom will ever be allowed to vote unless there's a massive shift in state law.
Florida's one of the worst states to commit a felony and expect ever to vote again because you won't be able to.
And the second in command of the folks who bring you your weather forecast gives his take on those who keep denying the nature of climate change despite scientific evidence. House and Senate leaders are patting themselves on the back for writing a new statewide water policy and spending more to restore the Everglades. But environmentalists are giving the 2016 session mixed reviews, as we hear from Jim Ash.
The session began on an environmental note, with both chambers agreeing to a massive rewrite of state water policy. Republican Senator Charlie Dean of Inverness rode herd on the bill for his chamber. A retired county sheriff, Dean is better known for consensus building than soaring oratory.
This bill has been a work in progress for the past 3 years. We finally have an agreement between the Senate and the House and are ready for passage.
Sponsors are congratulating themselves for tightening pollution standards and dealing with water shortages in Central Florida. But they're giving themselves too much credit, says the Florida Springs Council's Robert Palmer. He says the bill is full of loopholes. For example, it says groundwater withdrawals don't have to be measured if the pipe is less than 8 inches in diameter.
You can have a 6-inch pipe, you could pump 1 million gallons a day through a 6-inch pipe, and you wouldn't be required to meter that because it's not an 8-inch pipe. It's just silly.
Republican leaders were so eager for a quick bill signing ceremony, they didn't allow changes on the floor. House Democratic Leader Mark Pafford of West Palm Beach tried to add a key goal for the Springs Council. His amendment would have led to limits on the amount of groundwater that can be pumped from a single water management district.
Permits are analyzed individually, cumulative effects are discounted, actual data on water flows are ignored in favor of model predictions. There is an inherent bias towards granting permits for economic reasons.
Audubon of Florida Executive Director Eric Draper says the legislation gives regulators more power to enforce pollution standards.
One of the things that we're happy about in the water bill was that it toughened up the enforcement requirements for the practices that farmers use fertilizing their fields and with animals, and it also required enforcement of the overall cleanup plan.
Just as important, lawmakers budgeted money for agricultural inspectors to make sure best management practices are working, Draper says. Republican Senator Garrett Richter of Naples argued his industry-backed fracking bill was another favor for the environment. It created a permitting program for hydraulic fracturing, and Richter insists gave regulators a power they lacked. Richter also called energy production a national priority.
I believe that we as a state and we as a country should do everything possible we can do to increase the amount of resources and energy resources that we have.
But protesters flooded the Capitol, and the bill died in a dramatic showdown in Senate appropriations. At a time when lead-poisoned drinking water dominates the headlines, Republican Anna Terry Flores of Miami wasn't willing to promote more oil and gas drilling in Florida.
That just leaves us with too many unanswered questions as to what does fracking mean for our environment? What does fracking mean for our children?
Republican Representative Matt Caldwell of North Fort Myers sponsored the lands bill. It would allow landowners to lay claim to state property abutting their land if they agree to give up development rights. Environmentalists dropped their opposition when he agreed not to allow land conservation money to be spent on pumps and pipes. In the end, legislative leaders agreed to spend $280 million for Everglades restoration and addressing pollution in the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers. Under the budget just approved by Governor Rick Scott, land acquisition will rise from $60 million to $90 million. But Sierra Club lobbyist David Cullen says it's a far cry from the days Florida spent $300 million a year.
Those are substantial dollar figures, but I don't believe that the environmental community is anywhere near satisfied.
But Cullen says there's always next year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Florida's closed primary election caused confusion and frustration this past week as some voters were turned away from the polls. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Florida has a closed primary system. That means someone hoping to vote for Marco Rubio or Donald Trump in last Tuesday's presidential preference primary needed to be registered as a Republican. And registration as a Democrat was required to vote for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton. Leon County Election Supervisor Ian Sancho says that can be confusing.
Particularly if you're listening to the news media out of New Hampshire, where independents may choose whichever party they wish to vote for, that is not the law in Florida.
Sancho says his office did its best to spread that message to local voters, and so did many of the campaigns. Oliver Glace is a volunteer with a university student group supporting Sanders.
We were calling a lot of people, telling them who were independents, you know, but if you really want to vote for, say, Bernie or Hillary, then you're going to have to register, you know, Democrat, unfortunately, even though you might not be totally with that party.
But the state's elections chief, Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner, says despite those efforts, the state's closed primary did trip up some Florida voters. On the night of the primary election, Detzner announced some voters in Palm Beach County raised concerns they weren't allowed to vote for Donald Trump. But Detzner says that confusion may have arisen from voters who were registered as NPA, or no party affiliation.
Some people get confused. They may have been NPAs, non-party affiliations, and they may have expected that they could vote. But the fact is that Florida law does not permit them to vote.
Meanwhile, back at the polling place, Glace says closed primaries don't make sense to him.
I don't think they're entirely fair because I know a lot of people who are independents and, you know, they'll have some conservative viewpoints, then some liberal viewpoints. So, you know, they'll be kind of leaning both ways a lot of times. And I just think it's really not all inclusive.
The number of voters who are registered for minor parties or with no party affiliation at all is growing. And at about 3.5 million, University of Florida political science professor Daniel Smith says it makes up a significant portion of the state's voters. He also says many of those voters are young.
Yeah, younger people, those who are under the age of 30. We have about 880,000 Floridians who are registered as a no-party affiliate or a third party. And that's actually more than who are registered as a Democrat or as a Republican. There are about 2.3 million voters who are registered and under the age of 30, and you can see this sizable chunk who are essentially voiceless.
Smith says people tend to register NPA or with a third party when they feel put off by politics and don't feel they can fully identify with either major party. And he says Florida's closed primary system risks increasing that feeling among voters. But he says it's not fair for voters to say they've been disenfranchised.
The parties have a very good rationale to keep their parties closed. If you don't feel compelled enough to join a political party, why should you have a say in terms of who its leader should be, either at the presidential level or at the sub-state level, or at the state level in terms of picking a governor or a U.S. senator? So I don't think that's disenfranchisement.
And while Smith says there could be an argument for moving to open primaries, he says there's also an argument for voters to be more involved. He says voters who are unhappy with the current parties could register with one anyway and work to change it by voting in new leaders. Florida's presidential primary election ended Tuesday. Officials say overall the election went smoothly. On Election Day in November, all voters, regardless of party registration, will have the opportunity to vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Of course, this past Tuesday, the Florida electorate was minus a significant chunk of the population who would have been able to vote in most other states. Kate Payne reports some 1.5 million Floridians couldn't vote because they were once convicted of a felony.
Florida's one of the worst states to commit a felony and expect ever to vote again. Because you won't be able to.
That's Richard Scherr, a political science professor at the University of Florida. Under state law, all felons have their civil rights permanently removed, including their right to vote. There is a process to get those rights back involving an extensive application and review process before the state's clemency board, also known as the governor's cabinet. Desmond Mead heads the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He says he's working with a man who's been waiting for a hearing since 2007.
You're looking at an American citizen waiting upwards of 15 to possibly 20 years after they have completed their sentence to be able to have a hearing to see if their rights will be restored. And even then, it's not guaranteed.
Michael McDonald specializes in American elections at the University of Florida and the Brookings Institution, and he says Florida's rights restoration process is one of the most stringent in the nation.
Florida is on the extreme on this. Florida not only disenfranchises prisoners, they also disenfranchise people who are on parole or probation, and they disenfranchise people who have been ever convicted of a felony.
And even in Florida, the process has varied considerably under different governors' administrations. Under former Governor Charlie Crist, over 100,000 felons regained their voting rights. That flow has slowed to a trickle under Governor Rick Scott, who has restored rights to about 2,000 people. Here's Desmond Mead again.
And I could tell you this. We believe that the decision on which American citizens get the right to vote and which do not get the right to vote should not be left in the hands of any politicians, whether they be Republican, Democrat, or independent.
In Florida, disenfranchised felons make up about 1/10 of the voting population, and researchers say there are political ramifications for these policies. Richard Scherr says there's a psychological burden as well.
They carry the mark of Cain with them forever. I mean, it just means that, no, they're not really restored to full citizenship. They're not really first-class citizens, even if they paid their debt to society. You know, they've served their time.
Critics of civil rights restoration say if you break the law, you shouldn't have a hand in shaping the law. Richard Scherr has something to say on that front.
People who skirt around the law are nonetheless involved in shaping it. So I don't really see where there's a big difference between them and the felon. I think what the real issue is, A, race. But B, also, that we carry around this notion that, you know, once a criminal, always a criminal.
Like many aspects of the criminal justice system, Michael McDonald says felon disenfranchisement disproportionately affects black men.
Does not escape civil rights groups' notice to say that this is a burden that substantially falls upon African-American males, who upwards to a quarter of them are ineligible to vote in Florida because of their felony status.
Greg James is a reverend and community organizer in Tallahassee, and he's also a former felon.
I'm one who cannot vote. Paid my debt, paid my restitution, served my time, but I can't vote. but I do have a voice.
But a voice is not a vote. That's why Desmond Meade and the group Floridians for a Fair Democracy are vying to put a constitutional amendment on the 2018 ballot to establish automatic rights restoration. That amendment won't come in time for people hoping to vote in the 2016 presidential election. Florida's Clemency Board will meet two more times before November, but folks will have to get in line. There's a backlog of some 20,000 cases. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, environmental science graduate students at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee were showing off their research projects today. One of those students is Darius Bell. He's been studying the impact of various environmental factors on a particular kind of fish that lives in Maryland's Choptank River.
You want to really look at the health of these fish, which are the white perch that are highly abundant in this Choptank habitat focus area, and kind of relate that data from the fish health to the health of the habitat in which they live, which is that focus area.
Bell and other FAMU student researchers have a very interested and attentive audience for their presentations. He is former U.S. Coast Guard Vice Admiral Manson Brown. 1 year ago, President Obama named Brown Deputy Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA. Brown says he likes what he was seeing.
It really is a compliment to everything we're doing in our labs. And everything we're doing with academia throughout the nation, with the industry, and with the other federal labs.
Brown says this research helps NOAA in its mission to provide early warnings on several levels.
NOAA is really in the public safety business. We provide environmental intelligence to members of the public about things like environmental threats, weather, tornadoes, hurricanes, all manner of environmental threats.
Brown says things like sea level rise connected to climate change is one of those threats, even though public policymakers, including some in Congress, insist there is no threat.
There are a lot of people out there who think they're scientists themselves and can come to the conclusions based upon their own reading of the literature. Quite frankly, 97% of the scientists on the globe have come to a consensus about the human impacts on the environment and climate change.
And Brown says that consensus is what will drive NOAA's alarm bells, although he suspects more and more people will be convinced as time goes on.
All it's going to take is greater frequency of severe weather and greater severity of weather. We've seen some of those things manifest just in the last year, like the thousand-year flood in the Carolinas. It's not going to take too many more episodic events like that for everyone to wake up.
In the meantime, Brown says the scientific research evidence compiled by partners like Florida A&M University will keep piling up. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Esch, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.